As someone who spends a fair amount of time writing for the radio show and also for the magazines, I do know how important it is to have a great place to do my writing. And I have with me today another individual who is quite familiar with this idea, and this is Joan Dempsey, a graduate of both the MFA in Creative Writing and the Postgraduate Certificate for the Teaching of Creative Writing Programs at Antioch University in Los Angeles. Joan Dempsey is a writer and writing teacher. Her work has been published in the Adirondack Review, Alligator Juniper, Plenitude Magazine, Obsidian, the Citroen Review, and has been aired on National Public Radio. Joan writes and teaches from The Shed in New Gloucester, where she's lived for the past 9 years with her partner Bert and their two dogs, Logan and Bee, and two cats, Maggie and Little Jack. Thanks so much for coming in, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
As I'm reading this, I'm just picturing this place and your little family of animals, Logan and Bee and Maggie and Little Jack. And it seems like you've really created a space for yourself in New Gloucester.
Yeah, absolutely. The shed that I work from when we moved here 9 years ago was a chicken coop and a tool shed. And as soon as I saw it, even before we moved in, I thought that's going to be my space. So I designed the interior of the space, and the structure was in good shape, but we had it renovated, and now it's full of books, and it's my own space, and I work like crazy, and I leave the door open so the animals can come in and out.
Where did you come from? Where are you originally from?
I grew up in New Hampshire. And then I spent the probably 22 years living in Boston, and went back for a short stint to New Hampshire, and then came to Maine 9 years ago.
And somehow managed to have a connection also to Los Angeles.
Yeah, that really was, Los Angeles was never a place I thought I would be interested in or want to go. You know, I had probably the stereotype that a lot of people have, big, smoggy, lots of traffic. But when I started looking for MFA programs to study writing, that one really jumped out at me. And they have a nice focus on social justice. They have a really diverse population of students who go there. And it's a low residency program. So I went twice a year for, and it ended up being 2.5 years. And it was just fantastic. By far the best learning experience I ever had. Really tremendous.
What was your other life before you went back?
I've had several lives. I love to sort of go where my interest takes me. So I spent some time after college exploring the world of graphic design. I took some classes at Mass College of Art. I managed a small design firm for a time in Cambridge. And then I discovered that everything was moving online, and I liked the tactile part of design, so I decided that wasn't quite for me. Then I jumped into the peace movement. I did anti-nuclear work for many years with a bunch of lawyers, and got a master's in nonprofit management. And then I jumped into animal welfare, and I spent 10 years working at the Massachusetts SPCA, primarily as a lobbyist and animal advocate. And somewhere along the line there, I dipped my toe into writing, and that's my true passion for sure.
So as you were moving from graphic designer to peace, social justice, animal welfare activist to writer, how did you determine that this dipping of the toe, that this was your passion? What was it about the writing that really called to you?
Well, the thing about the writing that called to me is that I think it's the thing that has been the most consistent over time. Each of those areas I got very excited about. I got excited about learning all I had to learn. And then I reached a point where I was done, where I felt like, you know what, I've learned all I can learn, and I'm ready to move to something else that catches my interest. But when I started writing, my first workshop, I was probably about 30 years old. I took it at Grub Street Writers in Boston. They were very new at the time, but they're a lovely writing school now. And I knew in that first, the first session of the first workshop I took, that this is the thing I wanted to do. And that was because I sat down to do an exercise and this character just appeared to me. And I had always, frankly, thought that was a crock. When I heard writers say that, I thought, oh, come on, you create this stuff. But it happened in my first writing exercise, and this character came, and I just followed him, and I really fell in love with the work. And then over time, I've just continued to take workshops, and then I got my MFA. And I think it's the fact that every time I write something new, I'm entering a new era. So I have that love of following my passion in different topics, wherever it goes, and writing sustains that, and I can't imagine it will ever stop. I'm both learning about the craft of writing constantly, and I'm learning about new topics as I research them for the next book.
Why did you decide also to get this postgraduate certificate for the teaching of creative writing?
It was a twofold decision. I love teaching because I not only can help other folks, but I learn things more deeply myself. So it was that, and there was also the practical matter. I knew enough about the world of writing to know it's not an easy way to make a living, and I thought, well, maybe I'll go into academia and this will be helpful to me. I ultimately decided after doing a stint in academia, a short stint, that I would get really sucked into doing that work and I would leave my writing aside. So I decided not to go that route. But teaching still really moves me. And it moves me because I can help other people have that great experience that I had of falling in love with the work. And right now what I'm doing is teaching on my own. I've got my own business and I'm teaching people online primarily, and it's just endlessly rewarding. So,
as you've created this space for yourself, the Shed in New Gloucester, what things have you learned about yourself? You've gone from a very outward facing direction where you're dealing with people and lawyers and animals, and you've gone more inward. You've created this little space, a little almost like an eggshell to kind of protect you in some ways, but also it's porous enough, as you said, that your dogs and cats go in and out, people go in and out. So tell me.
Well, I think the most important thing that I've learned is that I feel like I've arrived at a place where I know what works well for me, and I'm outward in many other ways. I am an extrovert, and I do get energy from being out in the world and being with other people and talking with other people. So I have not lost that piece. I spend my days primarily by myself, working in the shed. And what I love about that and what works really well for me is that I'm in charge of everything. I get up when I want to get up. I take a walk when I want to take a walk. And I work harder, I think, than I've ever worked, because what I'm doing, I love. But I get to make decisions every day about what I'm going to do. And if I don't have anybody else that I'm accountable to, so I don't have any politics that I have to deal with about getting approval or getting consensus or any of those things. And while I was good at that when I did it, it also had its frustrating moments of trying to move ahead, trying to get something done, feeling like it just takes so long to get anything done with groups of people. So now I just get so much work done. I work all day and it's fantastic.
So we're lucky to have you then.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but...
Well, just the fact that we've gotten you to leave the shed, I guess,
point. This is a perfect example, though. You know, if I was working a full-time job, I would have had to arrange that. But, you know, I got the call and I thought, sure, why not? And my schedule is my own, so here I am.
Well, I do love this, and I have to say, of all of the writers that I've interviewed, and we've had a few on the show, you're the only one who said, I'm an extrovert.
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty... I think there's also a myth that many writers are introvert, and I think many are, but I'd love to see a study about that, because I certainly am not an introvert, and there are plenty of writers I know who are also not introverts, but I do think there's a tendency for writers to be sort of... You know, they get their energy from being inward instead of outward.
And having worked with writing teachers before, one of the things that they've mentioned to me is that writing becomes such a personal exercise that there's often almost a therapy that takes place if you're talking with, say, a person about their personal essay or even mm-hmm. a novel. Mm-hmm. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And what I find is that there are some folks where it's very directly personal, where they're setting out to tell a personal story. They know that they're doing that. The thing I'm more interested in, and this particularly happens in fiction, is when there's a lot of deep psychological stuff going on that the writer isn't aware of until after the fact. That certainly has happened to me, and I have seen it time and time again with writers that I work with on their manuscripts. They know what they're writing about and the topic they're writing about, and somewhere along along the line discover, oh, gee, this is about my fill in the blank. And I think that the best writing comes from that place where there's an unconscious depth of emotion that comes out almost in spite of what the author is intending. And that kind of deep writing is some of the best I think there is.
Do you think that fiction can be helpful in some ways? Because when you're writing a personal essay, it's about your life and oftentimes about people that are still living and about conflicts that still exist. Whereas fiction, you can pour a lot of something into it and it doesn't have to be completely real.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the beauty of fiction. I remember at some point when I was working on my first novel, I was just racking my brain. I can't remember the specifics, but I know I was thinking, did this really happen in the real world? Did it happen? And I was researching and trying to find it, and suddenly I thought, I'm writing fiction. I can just make it up. And that was so nice. So, I mean, writers do want to get the facts right, and they want their work to be believable, but the beauty is it is fiction, and you can make it up, and that sometimes saves you.
Over the course of my time, I've written a couple of novels which have not yet been published, and somebody read them over with me, and she said to me, it's very interesting that the men in these novels, which I wrote several years ago, she said, they all seem to be men talking at you. She called it mansplaining, where some men have this tendency to talk to women as if they don't really know very much. She said, do you know that all of your characters are like that? I said, I had no idea. Huh. How interesting that is, because I actually think that in my life I have attracted a fair number of men who would like to tell me things, uh-huh, just by nature of, I guess, my personality. Uh-huh. It's less so now, but isn't that so interesting? That's that here I am writing a novel and then the men are all a certain way.
Yep, there you go. This is a perfect example. Perfect example. And you couldn't see it yourself, but when someone pointed it out, you thought, oh, and reflected on something in your own life. And that's the other piece that I love about this work, is that you continue to grow. You know, you don't ever stop growing as a person and as a writer. And I can't think of a better way to spend my time.
So tell me what your first novel was about. Because I'm interested in how you've progressed from your first novel to the novel that you're working on now.
Well, I've written two novels, neither of which are published. One, my first one is in a drawer. The second one is with agents right now in New York. And the third one is still the seed of an idea. My first novel, I think, was my learning novel. It's a quiet literary novel, primarily about death and the ways in which we choose death. Agents loved it and said, we can't sell this because it's too quiet, too literary, and given the market, it's going to be tough. So, but I learned how to write a novel from writing that book. My second novel, which is out with agents right now, I'm quite excited about. I deliberately wrote it as a literary page turner so that an agent could say, yes, I can sell this because it is a good read. My readers have told me enough, and I trust my readers, that it's a good read. Also about sort of dark subjects, though. It involves the Holocaust, a Holocaust survivor, art theft, but it's set in 2009 and also deals with issues of homophobia. So there's some pretty serious stuff going on, but it's a really moving plot. And you ask, you know, how I move from one to the other. Again, I go where my interest lies. You know, what do I find myself reading about and thinking about when I'm not even thinking about writing? I tend to find a topic that's of interest to me and then just go and read and watch and listen to anything I can listen to. So the one that I'm exploring right now is looking at wrongful imprisonment. I have a judge character lurking in the background and a jury sort of lurking as well. And I don't yet know who's going to come forward and say, this is my book. But I've really been binge reading and binge watching anything that has to do with wrongful imprisonment.
These are some heavy topics that you've drawn to you in your life. You've already talked about being part of the peace movement, and you've talked about animal welfare. Mm-hmm. You've written about death and wrongful imprisonment. Mm-hmm. Where does all that energy come from?
Well, I don't know. You know, I remember a friend of mine saying, I spent I spent two long weeks down in Washington at the Holocaust Memorial Museum when I was writing the last book, and I got a grant to spend time there. And every day I would go there and go to the archives, and I would sit and watch testimony from survivors, just, you know, talking head, talking for hours, and I couldn't get enough. It was just fascinating to me. And so I think for me, there's something, and I haven't really formulated this yet, but it seems to me there's something about helplessness and giving voice. Certainly animal welfare work is about giving voice to animals who can't speak for themselves. That's a common thing that's said in that movement. And when I was doing anti-nuclear work, we were working with a lot of folks who had been impacted by nuclear fallout, essentially. And certainly in the Holocaust, you're dealing with victims. So there's something in there that pulls me in. And certainly with wrongful imprisonment, there is a helplessness due to the system for these folks who, you know, become in prison through no fault of their own. So there's a thread there, and I'm just kind of learning about it now. What is it about it that attracts me to that? But I think it's something about voicelessness and helplessness and how to have those people come forward and speak out and be heard.
Joan, tell me about your growing up years. You said you're from New Hampshire mm-hmm. originally.
Right.
Was there anything in your family background that caused you to be interested in, I guess, giving characters voice or giving animals voice or giving other people voice?
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in New Hampshire. I was born in New Jersey, but my parents went back to the land in 1970. So I was a second grader and moved to rural New Hampshire, and they started a health food store and that whole bit. And my parents were very, and my mother still is, very liberal and really had a keen sense of social justice. My father had been a teacher in New Jersey, and he ended up standing up for somebody who had been fired for really prejudicial reasons, and my father lost his job as well. We had books all over the house. There was an entire section about race, which I'm not sure actually where that came from, but I still have all those books that my father had studied. And I don't know where that came from in him, but there was definitely a sense of looking out for people who are less fortunate. And certainly we always had a lot of animals, and that was a big part of my growing up.
You described the reason that you went into graphic design originally was that you liked the tactile nature of it. Is there a tactile aspect to writing?
Well, there is. Certainly writing with pen and paper is very different than writing on a computer. And there have been studies done about that I can't quote, but I know they exist, about the sensation of physically writing on paper and how that pulls something different out of you than typing on a keyboard. The other thing is, as a writer and as a teacher who's trying to promote my business of teaching, I get to do a bunch of graphic design anyway. You know, I because I work solely alone, I don't have designers I work with, so I still get to dabble in that realm when I'm promoting courses and trying to attract people to working with me.
Well, it's very interesting because as you are talking about the tactile nature of this, the characters, there is a tactile aspect. I mean, they might be only in our minds as we're creating them, but they become very, I don't know, very real, very embodied. So there's something about them that if whether you're writing it or whether you can reading it, mm-hmm. you can almost touch them in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because one thing, and I don't know if you've done this since you've written some novels yourself with your characters, but there are times when I, alone in the shed, physically either try to evoke an emotion or I act out something physically that I'm trying to describe. In my current novel, there's a scene where this guy gets beat up, and it's a very quick beating up, but I've never been beat up, and, you know, of course I've seen it on television, etc., but I thought, I was in the shed literally like falling to the ground to see how, you know, where would I hit first on the ground if this had happened, that sort of thing. So that piece is something that I do. And the evoking emotion to really get to how do I feel about something, I will, if a character is going through an emotion, I will sit at my desk, and probably much like an actor does, and try to physically conjure the emotion in myself so that I can begin to feel it and then observe what's happening. Am I getting goosebumps? Does my stomach really hurt? Because there are a lot of cliches about how you can describe emotion. You know, what does that really feel like in my throat? Is it really thick or is it something else? You know, so these are the kinds of things that occupy my mind. You know, another experience I had, and this is slightly different, but it is that physicality. In my first book, and this happened with my second book as well, in the first book I had a dream that I was the main character in my book. I had been struggling to really get inside of him, and I had a dream where I was inside of him. And that was fascinating. That carried me through the rest of the novel because I felt like I know what it feels like to be him because I have been. And then in the most recent novel, my main character, I was helping her do something. She's an elderly woman, so I physically felt her in that dream.
When we had the author Lois Lowry on, she was talking about being able to physically remember various stages in her life. She physically remembered being a child, I think, at the age of 7, and what it felt like to be in the classroom. And it wasn't just she remembered it,
right,
you know, as an intellectual exercise. Right. She kind of embodied that, that memory.
Right.
And I don't know how many people have that ability, but it sounds like what you're doing is this sort of evocation of that physicality.
Yeah, definitely. And I have definitely experienced what I call, and I don't know if anybody else calls it this, but I call it body memory. So, you know, if you say, for instance, you've lived in a house for a long time and you walk into the kitchen and the fridge is on your left and it's always on the left. So you develop this body memory of walking into that kitchen and opening the fridge in a certain way. When you go to another place, you often do that even if the fridge is over on the other side of the kitchen. And I think that's the same thing that Lois is talking about. And she can put herself back in other places in time, but she feels it inside. And I definitely have that. One of my strengths, I think, as a writer is that I see places in my fiction as clearly as I see this studio that we're sitting in. And they're completely made up fictional places, but I could draw it, I could stage it. I see that very, very clearly. And I can feel what it's like to be in that space.
So that being the case, it seems like the making of your shed, of your space, was particularly important. You actually, the spaces are so important to you that you actually needed to have this place that was yours.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about the shed and the reason why my artist or writer friends, when they come and see it, you know, tell me they hate me because they're so jealous of the space is that it's very important for me to have a space that's mine alone, because the psychological energy it takes to do the work is a lot. And to minimize external distractions and have everything around me sort of being supporting that energy is super important. And I really advise it for any writer or any artist to make sure they claim that space for themselves and make it happen somehow.
I think you're probably right about people being envious of the space. I mean, I think of the song that all I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air.
And this is with one enormous chair.
Exactly. It's not even a place that necessarily we might write, but it's a place that we might return to and a place that might cradle us somehow.
Absolutely.
And then if you are able to return and be cradled, then from whenceforth creativity and books and all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I feel that way about where we live and our place. When Bert and I came here 9 years ago, the first morning I woke up in that house, I felt like I'm home. And I hadn't felt that for quite some time. And so it is that sort of safe home place that we can move out of and be creative. So I feel very fortunate in that way, in that I'm able to go home and venture forth from home and come home.
And it's interesting that you are from your shed creating a novel about false imprisonment.
So, I know. So, go figure.
That's a very interesting irony that you're working through in this novel.
It certainly is. Or maybe it's just that I feel so sorry for those folks who are locked up and, you know, trying desperately to get out and find their own place that they can come and go from. You can't come and go from prison, so.
Well, Joan, I give you so much credit for having followed this path, and really when you understood that this was your passion, kind of locking down on that, and really I just love this approach that you're taking, because there are many people in the world who kind of secretly think, oh, I wish I could do whatever it is,
right.
But you're doing it.
Yeah.
You're doing it, you're building it, you're creating it, and it's pretty wonderful that you have this place that you've developed.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'll be looking for your novel, your second novel.
Great.
And then at some point when it's not too literary and people appreciate you more,
right.
Your first novel will be published too. Well, I'll be looking for the first novel by Joan Dempsey. How can people learn more about The Shed and the teaching that you're doing and the writing that you're doing?
Sure. You can find me online at joandempsey.com.
We've been speaking with Joan Dempsey, who is a writer and a teacher and also inhabitant of The Shed in New Gloucester. And thanks for coming in. And please say hi to Bert and your dogs, Logan and Bee, and your cats, Maggie and Little Jack.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.